talking today with Scott Deal, a highly respected businessman and angler who started Maverick Boat Company in 1984 after discovering and fishing out of the original Maverick hulls built in the 1970s. Since that time, he's built Maverick into a dominant brand in both the skiff and bay boat markets. Welcome, Scott.
Oh, well, thanks, Marshall. I appreciate you calling and giving me the opportunity to chat.
Your reputation today is mostly as a successful businessman, but many listeners don't know what I know, which is that you were involved in the development of modern performance skiffs and small boats as anyone. You knew and fished with many of the craftsmen of that time and the anglers who were inspired in the 60s and 70s to come up with the really truly fishy boats. So tell us a little bit about your role in moving those ideas along.
Well, I think your statement, moving the ideas along, I think is really good because, as I think a lot of people recognize, we all build on, you know, the accomplishments and the hard work and tutelage of people that have come before us, all the way back to the guys that were taking wooden skiffs with 200-pound, 20-horse outboards and taking half a day to get out to Buchanan Bank or Nine Mile Bank and fish. And, you know, those guys developed a fishery and that we take for granted is just always was known and always was understood. And it's just not the case. I mean, someone had to go out there. Somebody had to decide that they could catch these fish on light tackle. And then somebody had to figure out how to do it. And it certainly wasn't me. And it certainly wasn't even in my generation. So, yeah, I do think that I helped move those ideas along on skiff design. You know, my history was such that I lived in the Keys, and I had purchased a old 18 Maverick from a guy named Herman Lucerne, who many of you know, and he and I became really good friends. He had a houseboat on the bay side of Flamingo, not Florida bay side, but whitewater bay side of Flamingo. And there was a fishing community there that I was really lucky and blessed to be introduced to. Ted Jurassic had the houseboat next to him, and Herman's houseboat sort of was, you know, a rallying point, a meeting point for people who would either come and stay or come and have a drink after fishing all day or come for dinner. And you know, I just got introduced to a whole lot of people. But the fishing that we did there mostly was what I'll call backcountry style fishing. And for that old 18 Maverick was absolutely perfect. And I used to take people out and do that style of fishing in Whitewater Bay and the oyster bars north of Shark River and somewhat out front, but of Flamingo, you know, the grass flats areas. But mostly I was a backcountry snook redfish guy, and the boat functioned very, very well. In the course of living in the Keys, I did a lot of nearshore and offshore fishing out of the boat, and I also did some bone fishing. Of course, tarpon fishing, primarily around the bridges. I ended up leaving my job with Xerox, and through a sort of an odd and another long story, ended up owning the molds to the 18 Maverick. At that point in time, in the mid-80s, 1984, there was no production of the Maverick boat, which was built ostensibly by a company called Berg Boats, which is owned by an eye surgeon in Fort Pierce, Lenny Berg, someone you may know. Great guy, big fisherman, used to be an eye surgeon in Key West, and certainly was involved in some of the early days of fly fishing down there. Fished a lot with Steve Huff and some other legendary people. Ended up buying the molds and started a subcontract relationship with his subcontractor, which was a company called Atlantis Fiberglass, and that's how we ended up in Fort Pierce.
I didn't want to interrupt you, but what kind of hulls were those? They obviously were very different than what you ended up building.
Well,
later on, but,
you know, the original Maverick was built by a guy named Wally Cole, C-O-L-E, out of Miami. He built a racing boat. Originally, it was an inboard racing boat, which was a modified version of a California drag boat called the Maverick. And he built the little boat called a Maverick. And a couple people convinced him to make a skiff design out of that, and he built a couple of them. I've spoken with Wally about that, and actually his son lives within a mile of my house in Vero Beach, And it was an interesting time because people were having to literally design and build their own versions of what we would later call flats boats. There were really, you couldn't just go buy a flats boat. There was nothing out there in the market to be made. So he made a couple of the tumble home, meaning it's sort of a curved aft transom boat, off of that, and made a skiff deck for it. And Guy Valdant, who was at Key West at the time with Tom McGuane and Jimmy Buffett and Jim Harrison and all those guys, you've probably seen in the
had the pleasure of fishing out of the boat I think you're about to describe. So
right, that was Gil Drake's boat, and Guy Valdant had one. I want to say there were a total of four of them produced. I could be wrong. There, to my knowledge, is only one of them left, and that was the boat that ended up as Jimmy Buffett's, which was formerly Guy Valdant's boat, and ended up as a display item at the IGFA Museum. I don't believe that boat's still there. But that was the boat called the Maverick, and it had a curvy shape to it and was kind of sexy looking, but it was prone to go through waves as opposed to over them and had some limitations. Well, Lenny Berg wanted one of those boats in the worst way, and Wally Cole said, look, that's not what I do. You know, I do racing boats and other things. But he said, I'll sell you the molds, and you can make your own damn skiff. And so Lenny bought the molds, but decided to make some improvements to the boat. So he took that set of tooling to another guy in Miami by the name of Les Stratton. I have never talked to Les Stratton, but this is a story that is related to me by Lenny Berg when we were acquiring the tooling. And Les said about extending the transom, straightening out the curves of the tumble home, and giving it a flat shear instead of the drop nose shear that the original boat had. And the two sponsons were live wells off the back. You may remember that boat as the original 18 Maverick. Yeah. And that was built by Berg boats for quite a few years, and they built a total of about 50 of them. And that was a great boat, and that's a boat that I ended up with from Herman Lucerne. And there's lots of vintage footage of that boat being fished by Stu App and Flip Pallet, and you know, some pictures of Eddie Whiteman, you know, with a world record bonefish caught out of Alamorada in that boat. And in its day, it was really almost peerless for ride and stability. But the fishery was different then, and that boat worked really, really well in the 70s. And when I started building them in the 80s and getting more into bone fishing as I got integrated into the Keys fishing community a little bit, I would go down there and, you know, learn quite a bit about bone fishing and tarpon fishing and fly fishing for these fish. You could still do it quite effectively in an 18 Maverick. At some point in time, I have to go back, I want to say it was probably 1990-ish, Mark Croca, who now is well known as just an absolutely dominant tournament captain and fishing guide. I don't know if you know Mark, but he's an exceptional human specimen. Anybody who has fished with him will understand what I mean by that. From the first time you shake hands with him and get crushed by the catcher's mitts on the end of his arms. You know, he's just a different guy and just an exceptional fisherman. It really taught me everything I know about bone fishing in the Keys. He really did. And I was fortunate enough to fish with him, and he suggested that we do a tournament together. And I'd never even considered doing a tournament, didn't know how the whole thing worked. And he said, you know, he'd call somebody and get me an invite to the Alamorada Fall Invitational Tournament, which was at that time a 5-day tournament, all fly. And that was the first tournament for both of us. And I had made a Kevlar vacuum bag shortened version of the 18 Maverick, which was our 1610. And we fished that boat. The boat was super light. We'd go plenty shallow. You had to be careful pulling into a wind chop because the boat had hull flap. It was a hard shine boat and had some hull flap. And we worked around that and approached flats to get around that issue, or Mark did because Mark was aware of the issues. But we still caught a lot of fish.
But the late 80s or the early 90s were the time when you were first sort of beginning to take these hulls and sort of shape them to what you envision to be.
Well, yeah, exactly. The boat was too hard to pull. Let's make it lighter. And, you know, everybody said, you got to make them lighter. Well, you know, the boats are displacement vehicles when you're pulling them. You know, they're not planing hulls. So they're just like a canoe in that respect. And you're shoving the boat with a stick. So shoving a big, wide, flat, you know, chine boat with a stick is always going to be harder than shoving a narrow one, irrespective of the weight.
Sure.
And so, you know, I learned in the course of poling these boats and fishing in these boats in extreme tournament-type conditions that, you know, it's hard. It's hard, and it needed to be easier. And then also that the footprint of the boat would affect the fish. And I get to the comment that Steve Huff made to me, and I'll get off of the tournament thing, I guess. But we were neck and neck with he, and I believe the guy's name was Bill Hassett, who was a great angler from St. Louis, and those guys had just cleaned everybody's clocks for years. And we, you know, Mark and I went for the minimum in the Calcutta, and, you know, we were nobodies. But we did well. We caught 20-something fish, I remember. I can't remember exactly. We got the largest bonefish. And then it was neck and neck to the last day, and then those guys ended up with a fish or two more than we did, and they won. So afterwards, at the banquet, whatever, Steve Huff said to me, and I remember it to this day, he said, well, just think how you would have done if you had a real boat, which, you know, kind of pissed me off, frankly. But then, you know, I said, well, okay, let's talk about that. And I started talking to him about boats a little bit. And, you know, observed that he was fishing out of this boat that he had built himself out of super skiff tooling and had done a, you know, beautiful job. I mean, he spent his time and, you know, one off to a unique boat for his needs and talked to more and more people about hull slap and shape and became intrigued with these little boats, which at that time, the only what I'll call little boat was a Dolphin super skiff. An interesting design, drew a lot of water, you know, even in a lightened version, because it had a very deep V and very little volume within the hull. So once you started putting people in the boat, it went down very quickly. So, you know, the effective fishing draft of that boat was at least a foot of water, which could be problematic. But it didn't make any noise, so it was killer for mudding bonefish and things like that when you're in the wind. And it tracked pretty well. Very well compared to some of the other boats on the market at the time. And in the course of that tournament, I became real friendly with Harry Spear and had fished, you know, several tournaments at that point and started talking to him about designing a boat. So he actually took me out in his super skiff and we discussed, you know, the virtues and the limitations of the design and, you know, understood, you know, I understood how to try to design a boat so that it would draw less water and wouldn't be so inclined to what I'll call dip on the ocean side where you're caught between swells, tarpon fishing, and the, you know, the bow goes down and the wave goes into the boat, which is something those boats did very badly, and how to make a boat run more efficiently. The power of choice was a 90 Yamaha, and so I designed a boat with a similar chine structure to Dave Exley's design. Dave Exley's the guy who made the hull that became the super skiff, and you know, I discussed his design, which how he came about it was quite interesting.
I heard a story that he had actually begun with that flat bottom. I think it was Banana River boat. Is that right?
Yeah, it's exactly. And you see those boats now. Dave Exley's original design was this flat bottom skiff, and you see these guys with tanks in them that go do mosquito ditch spraying. You still see boats of that hull shape driving up and down the roads today behind trucks, you know, for the mosquito impoundment ditches and things like that. But as he explained it to me, and I can only, you know, go on what he told me, is he was selling those boats, but they'd beat the crap out of you. I mean, they're flat bottom, and you know, he was in the Banana River and up in Merritt Island area, and he wanted to have a boat that rowed better. So he had an old Mitchell hull, and he cut the V off that ran. He liked the way the Mitchell ran. He cut the V off of the Mitchell and glassed it onto the bottom of this skiff that he had. But it didn't fit. You know, the lines didn't line up. So, you know, if you knew Dave, you'd understand that was probably okay for him because it did what he needed it to do. But that's where that flat chine structure came from. It wasn't an intentional design. He had no knowledge of nor interest in hull slap. And he put that design on the water, and it ran great, and he started selling a few of them. And I think Steve Huff's the one that saw that design and said that would make a heck of a flats boat.
Fascinating.
Yeah, but it was pure serendipity on his part. So I will definitely say that Dave is responsible for, you know, the chineless, you know, or the subwater chine design V-hull boat. You know, old Bahamian wooden skiffs are all, you know, flat chine boats, and they don't make waters. You know, I'm talking about the ones, you know, from the 50s and 60s and where people, you know, the Bahamian guys pull with a guava stick. You know, they don't make noise either, but they don't have any V to them. They're just flat bottom, and the chines go underwater. But this boat, you know, when you came off a plane, the chines went underwater, and the waves would go around the boat, and it made very little noise. There was a style line that made some noise, and there were some issues with some transom that made some noise. But by and large, the boat didn't make any noise. So I'll give Dave full credit for that one. And for those that don't know Dave, he's an interesting guy and gets full on into whatever he does. He had a business supporting homeschool people for years, where he provided learning materials for people that homeschooled. And then he decided to build canoes, and then he decides to build something else. And when he goes into something, he just goes into it. He's a real interesting guy and very, very, very intelligent guy. So I looked at that and said, well, that's a good idea, but, you know, I think the execution of the concept could be improved tremendously. And that's where the first Mirage came from. And so I worked on that design and talked with Harry Spear about it, and came out with the very first Mirage, and Harry was one of the first ones. Flip Pallet got one of the first ones, and Jose Wahebe got one of the early ones. They were really, really popular because it was probably, I want to say it was the same horsepower, maybe 8 miles an hour faster than a super skiff. It was actually legal to run a 90 on, which the Coast Guard formula for horsepower and beam to length numbers, as I recall, did not work out because the super skiff was only 15 feet long, and you could not support the formula the Coast Guard requires you to use to do the horsepower. Doesn't mean people didn't do it, but you know I wasn't going to do something like that would not be legal. So the original Mirage was a little over maybe 16 and a half feet and was dead quiet, and you know was really the first boat that was designed from scratch to be a poling skiff. You know, a technical poling boat from the first idea piece of paper. I use the term technical poling boat because people didn't really understand the difference between flats boats. You know, back then, half the people called them flat boats. You know, I want to get a flat boat. Well, you probably don't want to get a flat boat. You want to get a flats boat.
Right.
And, you know, for fishing the flats. And so, you know, trying to describe, well, why would I want a 17 Master Angler versus a Mirage, you know. And I don't know if you remember, Marshall, but we came out with an ad. You know, it was the boat for the 1 in 10. Meaning, if you have to ask why you need it, you don't. And so, you know, we had to differentiate the product line somehow. And so we talked in terms of the Master Angler series, which was what the original Mavericks were, morphed into Master Anglers and Mirages as a technical poling skiff. So if you're going to spend all day on the pole, you want a boat that is, you know, technical and designed for that. And those boats were carbon and fiber and Kevlar, but open layup. And then we kept refining the design. We had the Mirage. We had the Mirage 2. We had the HP. There's still some of those out, which was a great boat. That was the HP moniker was for... in honor of Harry Speer because it was for the Holy Polar. That's what HP stood for.
Great story.
So if anybody wonders how we come up with these monikers, it's sometimes there's a little backstory. But yeah, we designed HP with Harry. You know, he kept working with us to help refine our designs and try to make things better over the years. And then the latest generation series of Mirages is the HPX series. And we build the HPXs in, you know, V-hull, tunnel hull, and sort of what I'll call semi-V, which is the micro. And these boats are all built with vacuum-infused hulls and decks. And vacuum infusion is without question, the best and most advanced way currently available to us to build boats, irrespective of cost.
And that's just because the amount of resin that's required or left unused is lower, right? And so it lowers the weight of the boat, increases its strength. Is that the?
Well, it can do whatever it is you want it to do, mm-hmm. depending on how you design your laminates and your core systems. You can have a very resin-rich infused boat that's heavy, or you can have a super light boat that's infused. But whatever you set it up for and however you design it, it's completely 100% repeatable every time. Meaning if you design a laminate structure with a certain amount of fiber content, certain amount of core content, and it's going to, you know, your hull's going to take 26 gallons of resin, it's going to take 26 gallons of resin every time. Whereas when you're doing human factor manufacturing, there's always going to be some variation.
Sure.
Well, the way the infusion process works, what we call VARIS, which is Vacuum Assist Resin Infusion System, that's our proprietary system that we use here, the upper mold sets the tolerances. So, you know, we use a flexible upper mold so we get the maximum compression, and we have incredibly thin fiber on either side of, you know, high-density PVC foam cores. And that's the lightest way to build a boat. And I know we're doing a good job because I got a letter from Boeing's legal department saying that they think we're in violation of some of their patents related to aircraft. So you know you're on the right track when the guys in the white shirts and black coats show up.
What about on the structural foam side? Have any changes happened?
Massively,
in the last 10
years? When we first started, cross-linked PVC foam was available under the name Clegicel, was one of the more popular names. And when I got in the business, there were a lot of advancements just starting to hit the market. There was Clegicel, there was Aerosel, Divinicel, and the what I'll call the rigid foams, which were the PVC cross-linked foams like Divinicel and Clegicel, and now we use Corcel. They've stayed fairly much the same in the way that they're built and made or manufactured, but they've gotten better at process control and also in density control. So we use these foams and transoms when originally we used plywood transoms back in the first couple years, and you know, I'm going to say 85, 86. We still use plywood transoms because you didn't have the compressive strength available to you with those foams. Now you do. So we use a variety of densities in the boat depending on what it is we want to, you know, what the loads are. Is it compressive load? Is it going to be under impact load? Is it going to have a lot of tension? You know, that's how we design the laminates.
Well, a friend of mine who's a tournament fisherman recently told me that he uses a couple of different styles of skiff, actually, for different kinds of fishing that he does. But he said when it comes to competitive fishing, there is nothing that compares to an HPXV with a 115 on the back. And I think, you know, most people, I think, rightly assume that every boat is a compromise. There isn't any boat that that does it all perfectly for everybody in every style of fishing situation.
You know, certainly you see an awful lot of them being used in the tournament circuits and with the more serious guys down there. Your statement about the boats being a compromise is, you know, absolutely dead on. You know, you're going to have to make some kind of compromise. And, you know, you can move the meter one way or the other. And, the compromise might be more on the draft side and more of the open water capabilities, and that might suit one particular angler, and the other one might say, no, I need to get into 6 inches of water because I got to clear a bar before I can get back to where my redfish spots are. So the compromise is different for different people. For tournament angling, we designed the 17 HPX and, you know, to a certain degree, the 18 HPX, but certainly the 17 HPX is the best two-man flyboat that I'm aware of on the market because it will run the chop, it will run fast, and when you get there, it's still a very, very credible shallow draft boat and is extremely nimble on the pole, which if you're the kind of poling fisherman that, you know, goes out and looks at the sun and the wind and gets on a shoreline and poles downwind, down sun all day, you'll never know really, you know, the extremes of poling. Like a tournament angler that, let's say, is fishing a bonefish tournament and he's got a group of mudding fish in 3 feet of water on the edge of a channel and he's got to pole around those fish to get ahead of them to get a shot. When he's caught on the edge of the current in the channel and a 15-knot wind and, you know, his pole's going down, you know, 12, 13, 14 feet in the channel to try to get around the fish without letting them know they're there. And that's when you find out the limits, you know, that's when you find out what your boat can really do when you're poling. And not everyone does that. So for a tournament angler, he's going to have to do that. Or a tournament guide's going to have to do that a lot. And I think those guys tend to gravitate towards boats like the 17 HPX because they need them. I mean, it's a tool. We like to talk about our boats as tools. You know, they're not accessories. They're not gingerbread. They're tools to accomplish a specific mission. And we believe we've done a good job with the 17 and 18 HPX in that respect.
So you've done the tournament angling thing, and I know you were extremely serious technical bone fisher yourself for a number of years and very successful.
And redfish.
And tarpon.
And tarpon. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've won the bonefish tournaments and the tarpon tournaments and the redbone series. We did very, very well in that.
But your personal tastes, probably like everybody else's tastes, have changed somewhat in what you're doing.
Sure.
Where are you fishing? And so your taste in boats has probably changed too. Are there things that you look for now in a performance fishing skiff that fit your own lifestyle?
You know, I'm 52 now and sit at a desk a lot. And that's not necessarily the best thing for your, you know, physically. And when I go out all day on the water, you know, I feel it, especially on the littler skiff. I find the 18 HPX that we designed, it's much more stable than the 17. Still very easy to pull, very nimble. Not as nimble as a 17, but certainly close. But it's much more comfortable, and I find that if I fish in an 18 HPX all day, when I step off the boat and get on the dock, I feel a whole heck of a lot better. And the boat's designed with a deeper cockpit, so your knees are lower when you're riding the boat. I don't know if you follow what I mean, but
oh yeah,
you know, if you're driving a boat and your knees are up around your ears like a clown on a tricycle,
sure.
You're probably going to be pretty sore in the back by the end of the day.
Yeah.
So we designed that boat to be a little more versatile, a little, you know, more angler friendly, and it still pulls great and it's dead quiet and it's really fast.
Are there any particular aspects of boat design that you think that anglers underestimate the importance of? Are there things, you've sold a lot of boats and you must have seen people making choices about boats that they buy and coming back to you and saying, you know, I wish I had thought about this when I bought my boat?
Well, for years, you know, and I'm unique in that I have spent a lot of time with customers as a factor direct builder, in addition to, you know, developing into a, you know, sort of a national distribution network provider for, you know, our four lines of boats, not just our flats boats. So I do talk to the retail consumer and have for years, and, you know, I spend a lot of time talking people out of stuff when I'm talking to them. Because people tend to focus on, wouldn't it be nice if I could, dot, 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 and if I had, dot, dot, dot. And they, in their mind, every once in a while, yeah, I want to go do this or I want to go do that. And they option the boat to do all these things, but what they end up doing is messing up their 90% usage. So I'm always quoting the 90-10 rule that we have here, which is, you know, focus and set the boat up for what you're going to do 90% of the time and forget about the 10%, because they'll just mess up your 90% usage.
Do you think that accounts for some of the movement into more of a bay boat style, small boat, which used to be, as I think you've explained to me before, you know, sort of like the trash boat of the small boat industry, but has now gotten to the point where it really has become a performance class all by itself.
Yeah, the bay boats are certainly a much, much bigger part of our business and the industry in general than flats boats. Flats boats have become more and more narrowly focused and specific over the years, and bay boats have become more and more generalist and versatile over the years. You know, people like the idea that, you know, I'll take myself. I can get up in the morning early in the Indian River. I can jump, possibly catch a few tarpon first thing in the morning, run out the inlet. I can throw flies if I choose to out of my bay boat at tarpon swimming along the beach. And this time of year, the mullet schools are running right now, you know, weather permitting. I can run offshore, catch sailfish, which we do routinely out of our bay boats. And then I can come back in, and if I've got a good fallen tide and a low water situation, I can take some leftover scaled sardines, you know, live baits, and pitch them around and just have a blast and maybe catch 20 snook on the way home. And there are not a lot of boats that allow you to do all of those different things. And I think that's why people in certain parts of the country are really focusing on the versatile aspects of bay boats, because you can do so many things with them.
Well, you've seen a lot of changes in the boat business, and certainly it's changing all the time. If you could kind of look in the crystal ball and look out 30 years or 40 years or 50 years, where do you think it's going to be then? Can you see that far out? Are you thinking in terms of where the market will be? Changes in, obviously, demographics,
well, I think,
in the country and,
yeah,
and everything.
Yeah, you know, people are getting older. You see that going on, and the demographics support the fact that boats are getting continually softer. And by softer, I mean less hardcore. Hardcore is becoming a smaller and smaller percentage of the industry, and you're seeing a lot more boats with good seating. Because, you know, as people get older, you know, they want some comfort, and they want to be able to sit down once in a while and do some things. So you definitely are seeing that trend.
That almost sounds retro.
Industry-wide.
That almost sounds like we're going back to the days of the leather cushion seats.
Well, I don't know that it'd be leather, but if you pick up a publication, you know, a boating publication, and look at, you know, a lot of the manufacturers of the offshore boats, for instance, you will see that they're much more like giant deck boats now than, by and large, lots of them are. Not all of them, of course, but lots of them are. And a large part of the market is moving towards, you know, lots of seats, lots of, you know, seats with backrests in them, and, you know, lots of big plushy cushions, because people are getting older and not as hardcore about fishing. The flats boat side, I think, you know, the technical skiff guys have remained sort of the same demographic. It's a boat, you know, certainly the ones that, once people come of an age where they can afford to buy a good one, you know, and talking about new boat sales here, they're probably 30, would you say?
Yeah.
You know, they're not 18, although some 18-year-olds have them. But they're probably in their mid-20s to early 30s on the front end. And by the time they're 45, they're probably stepping off of the hardcore skiff and doing something else. You know, the 45-year-old guy is going to be a smaller percentage of the hardcore poling skiff than the, you know, I'll call the center of the market, which is probably a 35 to 38-year-old guy that's got enough money to get exactly what he wants and the freedom and control of his time to be able to do the hardcore fly fishing that's done in the Keys and, you know, Charleston,
sure,
for daily reds.
But even,
so as
even
the population ages, I see the flatboat market getting smaller.
Yeah. But I think it's also interesting the development of the flat skiff as a performance fishing boat, as a technical poling boat, has certainly influenced boat design. As you recall, most of those hulls back in the time they were being brought down to South Florida were coming from California. They were ski boats that were doing all these other things. But
yeah, the Sidewinder was the hull that became the Shy Poke and the Dolphin 18 Backcountry.
Mm-hmm.
That was a Sidewinder ski boat hull.
So those changes that were made to the poling skiffs, some of those carry forward, I'm assuming, into bay boats and improving bay boat design, and as you say, the flat deck on the bay boat, which didn't sort of exist in the old days. Do you think that there are other influences that skiffs have?
Sure, there's no doubt. We build, to my knowledge, we're the only guys that build bay boats that have walk-around gunnels and under-gunnel rod storage like a flats boat with rod tubes.
Yeah.
You know, that's taking the some of the really elegant features that were developed long before my time in flats boats that made them, such a great fishing platform, because you could get the rods out of the way where they would be safe and protected by the gunnels, and carry a brace of rods with you and not be tripping over them.
Sure.
And that's we definitely use that in our systems. Our live well systems are, much more advanced than they used to be, because we had to learn how to keep more bait alive in small confined wells. And I think, that's definitely moved into the bay boat market, as well as, our cord and lightweight construction. We don't build infused bay boats because I don't think the market's really ready for those yet. Certainly not enough of the market to justify the cost of doing the Varus on the Pathfinders, but we do everything we can to take advantage of our core technology experience to build things really light, get better performance out of them.
Well, Scott, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you for taking the time to explain your own personal history. And
I could talk for hours and hours, and I probably talked too much and went down way too many rabbit trails, but I appreciate the fact that you did give me a call and give me an opportunity, and hope that you're able to talk to some of the guys that predate me that really deserve an awful lot of credit and that I fear are not going to really be remembered for the huge contributions that they've made to inshore fishing, skiff design, rod design, lure design, fly line design over the years, because there's some real, real interesting stories to be told.
There really are, and as if you've shared some of those with us today, and I hope we can follow up with you on some other topics in the near future.
Happy to do it. Call me 888-SHALLOW anytime you want.
Thank you, Scott.